My guest at this time is Virginia Delegate Nick Freitas. He is also a candidate for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate in the Old Dominion. The primary is June 12th, and the winner takes on incumbent Democrat Tim Kaine. And Delegate Freitas, it's good to have you with us again.
Great to be on. Thank you for having me.
We spoke back in February, and a lot has happened since then. Right now, you're winning the money race in the primary. You've secured the NRA endorsement, and I'm seeing some pretty strong results in local straw polls. You're running against two opponents in Corey Stewart and E.W. Jackson, who have run statewide before, so they've got pretty decent name recognition, but you're doing well. So what do you think is working for you in this campaign?
Well, I think probably the most important aspect has been the field team we've put together combined with the messaging that we have. We've gotten really back to focusing on the core principles of the Republican Party of individual liberty, free markets, equal justice before the law. That message of this is not about trying to acquire political power in order to tell people how to live their lives. This is about protecting people's ability to live their own lives and make their own decisions. And that really resonates with people. And then when we get into the specifics of how we do that through tax policy, regulatory policy, education reform, national defense, again, it's just done very well. Obviously, we had a floor speech back in March where we were defending the Second Amendment. And when 40 million people see something, that helps with your name ID. But overall, we've had just an absolutely great field staff that is out there working hard every single day. And then the message is just resonating with people.
Corey Stewart nearly won the GOP gubernatorial primary last year, but ultimately came up short against Ed Gillespie, who ultimately came up short against Ralph Northam. Corey Stewart says his experience as Prince William County Board of Supervisors chairman, which is about half an hour south of D.C., shows that he can win in the blue part of Virginia, which is necessary to taking on Tim Kaine. And he essentially says that only he can do that. So what's your response?
Well, unfortunately, Corey kind of runs he thinks it's a divide and conquer campaign. I think it's more of a divide and lose campaign. And it's unfortunate because there are good things about Corey Stewart. And there are good things that he's done in Prince William County. But there's other things that he's done up there that have really given people pause. He's voted to raise taxes several times in Prince William County. And then there's been some other things that again, people are just skeptical of. So I don't really buy that argument. He talks a lot about how he almost beat Ed Gillespie, but we also got to remember that Frank Wagner was in that race, and I think that's probably about an extra 30,000 votes or so that would have gone to Gillespie. And then the fact that, right before the critical moment in the Trump campaign in 2016, they removed him from being chair. So, I wish Corey could just focus on some of the positive things he's done. Unfortunately, he spent a lot of time attacking me. But I guess what it is what it is. That tends to be Corey's style. But I think overall, when you look at what is it going to take to win in Virginia, the first thing that we need to understand is this. Donald Trump does not need a cheap imitation of himself in order to win in Virginia. There's only one Donald Trump. Let Trump be Trump. What he needs, and really what I think what the Republican Party needs in Virginia, is someone that can go around and explain and advocate for the positive, substantive policies that have made people's lives better. I don't care if you're in Southwest, if you're in Northern Virginia, if you're in coastal Virginia, the South Side, the Valley. If you've got more money in your pocket, if all of a sudden you've got a job because our tax reform and our regulatory reform made it easier for companies to set up and do business in the United States and in Virginia, those are positive things, and people are realizing that. And if you look at the overall numbers, 5 months ago, it was about a D+15 for the generic congressional ballot. Now it's a D+2, and all the momentum continues in our direction. So I think we need to be able to unify not just Republicans, but we need to be able to unify Virginians around a central message. And that message of we're going to empower you, not government programs, is something that we've found resounds with people or really is relevant to people regardless of where they are in the Commonwealth.
Delegate Freitas, I don't know if you like labels at all when describing yourself, but you definitely have strong conservative principles and some strong libertarian principles. I'm not sure if you consider yourself a conservative with libertarian streaks or vice versa, but and oftentimes the two philosophies overlap, but sometimes they don't. So I want to get your thoughts on a couple of the spots where the flashpoints exist. First, on foreign policy, you serve this nation honorably as a Green Beret in combat. Libertarians say we often intervene too much around the world. A lot of conservatives say President Obama's more hands-off approach in Iraq and elsewhere proves we need to play a leading role. How do you see it?
I think you can play. I think playing a leading role doesn't always mean using the military. And I would say this: when we have to go to war, when there is a clear national security threat, and when we have followed the constitutional process for going for war, then yes, I want to make sure that we have the best equipped, best trained, best provided for military in the world. Because when it is time to go to war, we need to be able to fight it effectively, quickly, and be able to get our people home alive. I do think that in large part, we play this role where we're like the world's police force. And in fact, it's one of the things that I really compliment President Trump on, is he understands that that is not a sustainable strategy. And really, it's not even the most conducive strategy for U.S. national security interests. So, again, if we follow the constitutional process, if there is a clear and present danger, then obviously we need to use our military force, and we need to use overwhelming military force. But let's not get drugged down into a bunch of conflicts where we're sending American men and women over to die, many times in conflicts that the people in that region are not even willing to fight for. And I think that really has to be the test. Is there a valid national security interest, and have we followed the constitutional process? And I do think right now the legislature has really abdicated its authority when it comes to the approval process before we send troops into harm's way.
Let's talk a little bit about cultural issues. I know you sponsored religious freedom legislation to protect the conscience rights of Virginians who do not want to be compelled to provide services for same-sex ceremonies or other events that violate their closely held beliefs. Tell us a little bit about that, and do you also believe that marriage is exclusively the union of a man and a woman?
Well, I always tell people, look, I'm a dedicated Christian, and so my beliefs about a lot of things, to include marriage, are influenced by my religious faith. The question then is, does the Bible give me authorization to impose my particular view on someone else? And what I find so interesting about the marriage debate in particular is that you've got some people wanting the government to define marriage one way. You've got other people that want the government to define marriage a different way. And I'm sitting here going, why is the government defining marriage? I mean, I understand why the government has to handle civil contracts, but I certainly don't understand why the government needs to be in the process of coercing people to accept a particular definition that they might not want to. And so I may have disagreements with other people with respect to human sexuality or marriage. The question is what's the appropriate role in governing that? And I would say it really doesn't have one. And the reason why I carry the religious liberty bill is because I do see this swing in politics where the government is taking more of an adversarial role with religious organizations, whether they be Christian or Muslim or Jewish or Sikh or whatever it happens to be. And in the situation that we had in Virginia, Terry McAuliffe had signed an executive order which essentially prevented any of these religious organizations that happened to hold the viewpoint that marriage was between one man and one woman from being able to team with the government in order to help hungry, sick, and addicted people. And I thought that was ridiculous. I thought that was an incredible overreach of executive power. Regardless of whether or not you agree with a particular religious group, I don't think anyone wants to step in and prevent them from helping people that need it. And I felt that's what the governor was trying to do. Unfortunately, the left really tried to caricature that bill as being discriminatory, and that wasn't the case at all. It was just trying to keep the government in its proper place and allow religious organizations, just like any other organization, to be able to get in there and help people when they need it.
And quickly on abortion, it appears from everything I've read, you are ardently pro-life. Is that correct?
It is, and I'll tell you why. I go back to I'm a big believer in individual liberty, right? I don't want government controlling people. You have a right to pursue happiness, provided that you don't infringe on the rights of someone else to do the same. And so the question for abortion always came down to, when does human life begin? Well, if you look at the science, it's pretty easy to figure out. If we look at all the scientific criteria we use to determine between a living entity and a non-living entity, we find that at the moment of conception, we're talking about life. If we use science in order to determine between human life and other forms of life, we find that at the moment of conception, we're talking about human life. And then finally, from a legal perspective, I don't think there's any doubt that we're also talking about innocent human life. So the question comes down for me is, does the government have an obligation to protect innocent human life? I think it clearly does. And so, it's not about trying to control a particular or to control a woman or pretending that I as a man understand everything that they're going through. But as I've said before, I don't know what it's like to be that young woman that finds herself pregnant and completely unprepared for it. But I do know what it's like to be her son. And I think what we need to start doing in this country is moving toward an environment where every single pregnancy is a wanted one, and where women that find themselves in a difficult situation know that there's going to be people there to support and come alongside them. But ultimately, I do think we have to defend innocent human life. And I think the other thing that really bothers me about the way the abortion industry has operated is that it's really taught young men to feel as if they have no responsibility to the women that they have a relationship with or create that life with. And so I really think we need a resurgence of men once again understanding that you have an obligation. You have a financial obligation. You have a social obligation to make sure that when you do create another human life, you're going to be there and be responsible and provide the support that that mother and that child need.
We're talking with Virginia Delegate Nick Freitas, candidate for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate. Let's move on to some fiscal issues in our last few minutes here. Delegate Freitas, since we last talked, the U.S. Congress approved a $1.3 trillion omnibus bill to fund the rest of the current fiscal year. It was effectively hammered out by four people and pushed to a vote without giving anyone time to read or certainly analyze it, and that was with Republicans running the show. So what can you do to change the culture on that front if you get to Washington?
I think a big key to this is transparency. And we've got a couple of senators up there like Rand Paul, like Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, and some others that really call out this sort of, I would say, irresponsible budgeting process. But we need more people to go up there and do it. I understand we had some people that voted for this omnibus because they wanted the increased defense spending. They want to properly take care of our military. And I can appreciate that as a combat veteran. But I'm also tired of being used as a political prop for fiscal irresponsibility. You don't get a strong military if you don't have a strong economy, and you can't have a strong economy if the government is consistently going into deficit spending, increasing the national debt, and really putting us in a bad position for the future. So I think we need a great deal more transparency on this process. I think when it comes to the whole omnibus, look, we could have funded certain things without funding other things. We could have said, look, we're going to pick up and we're going to look at the military issues, or we're going to look at the public safety issues, and we're going to fund those, and then we're going to have more of a debate on the issues for which there's more controversy or which more debate is required. But we see the same thing in Virginia right now. Look, on the things that we agree on that are legitimate functions of government, the military, law enforcement, public safety, certain things with transportation and others, great, let's fund those. But let's not hold those things hostage, because certain congresspeople have different goodies that they've got to hand out to various constituents in order to help their reelection chances. And so I think shedding light on it and coming out and being a vocal advocate against that sort of irresponsible budgeting is very important and something I'm certainly willing to do.
The last time we spoke was also around the time that Governor Northam was strongly pushing Medicaid expansion. In an odd role reversal, the House went with it, the Senate did not. And now, as far as I know, there's still an impasse on what exactly is going to happen. What has been your position through all this? The Democrats obviously say this is an effort to get people who badly need care. And others have said, of course, that this is government expansion that doesn't actually improve their health care that much. So explain where you're coming in on this.
Well, I've opposed Obamacare expansion because I think what we've seen across the board is that Obamacare has not been good for healthcare in this country. And the problem with expanding this program at this point is that if you look at what this program was intended to do and how far away it has gotten, and not only the fiscal consequences, but the health-related consequences of expanding this program when there are fundamental flaws that have to be addressed, there is billions upon billions of dollars lost in fraud, waste, and abuse. Some of the latest studies we've seen out of Oregon show almost no net health benefit between the people that qualify and receive it versus the people that qualify and don't receive it. And so what's so frustrating to me is that what we clearly need in healthcare is more competition and more market forces, which always have a tendency to increase quality and drive down prices. Unfortunately, there are many, especially on the left, the only solution they will accept is a government solution. And the problem is the government does the opposite of what we need. Government almost always causes prices to go up and quality to go down. If you look at the areas of our healthcare industry where we have just great innovation taking place and we have access increasing and affordability increasing, it's always in the most competitive sectors. It's things like LASIK eye surgery, where 5 years ago it was $2,500 an eye, and today it's less than $500 an eye, and the quality of the service is actually better. So look at any other area of your life, whether it's cars or smartphones or TVs or computers or services, you're going to find that when the market is allowed to operate and competition exists, it has a downward pressure on prices and we get greater affordability and access to people that need it. Whenever you have the government take it over and try to micromanage and control it, then you're putting the entire healthcare system at the mercy of whoever has the best lobbyist. So it's a bad idea to expand it. It was a bad idea 6 years ago. It's a bad idea today. And hopefully we're going to be able to continue to fight that. And again, we we can pass a clean budget without Obamacare expansion, then we can pick up that issue at a later date. I think that would be the fiscally responsible thing to do, as well as the morally and responsible thing to do from a healthcare perspective.
As we close, we'll close pretty much where we began. And I know you've been in a lot of debates with your primary opponents, so you're probably used to this. Why are you the best choice for Republican voters come June 12th?
Well, I think there's three reasons. And again, I don't want to disparage my fellow Republicans, but there's two that are experience-based and one that is philosophy-based. I'm the only combat veteran in the race, which means I understand a key component of the federal government, which is providing for national defense. I fought counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, unconventional warfare. And President Trump needs more people in the Senate that share his view that we are not the police force of the world, but we need a strong military, and I can provide that kind of advice. It also puts me in a position to understand the difficulty that many of our veterans face when dealing with organizations like the VA. We need massive reform there, and the sort of reform Tim Kaine is offering is ridiculous and is not going to achieve those sort of results that we need. I'm also the only candidate that served in the legislature, so I understand what it's like to take an idea from concept all the way through the legislative process. I know how to effectively engage constituents in the process when there's that critical vote in subcommittee or full committee. So I know how to get things done through the legislative process. And then finally, on the philosophical side, you know, I think unfortunately we have a lot of Republicans where their whole message is put me in power and I'll use government to help some people and hurt other people or punish our enemies or whatnot. That's not the role of government. My goal is to get into a position where we can disperse power back to where it belongs, and that's to the people, that's to states, that's to localities. And then let's keep the federal government within its proper boundaries so it can do its intended jobs well instead of doing 100 other jobs poorly. So this is about, for me, this is all about preserving individual liberty and giving people more control over their lives.
And finally, what's your website?
My website is nickforsenate.com. We encourage everyone to go there. Also, please check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We update everything very regularly.
Virginia Delegate Nick Freitas, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Nick Freitas is a candidate for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate. The primary is June 12th. I'm Greg Corumbus reporting for Radio America.